Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are just as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They're milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Betches Media presents.
If you feel depressed and if you feel anxious and you feel confused, you know what? Welcome to the club.
Gazpacho, please.
Oh my God.
What a stupid son of a bitch.
He believes that it's a woman's right, it's a woman's body, and it's her choice.
The Betches Sup Podcast.
Sayonara, sucker.
Hello, I'm Amanda Duberman.
I'm Sammy Sage.
I'm Caitlin Burr.
And this is the Betches Sup Podcast, where C-SPAN meets the group chat to help you process and laugh at the biggest topics in U.S. news and politics. I trust the three of us are doing well because we are in neither shooting nor driving distance of Madison Cawthorn.
Seriously.
The man.
What the menace to society.
Like, honestly, this is antisocial behavior. No?
That's a perfect, that's absolutely what it is. We are not into, generally not into making diagnoses, but that is accurate.
I'm just describing the behaviors. Yes. Like your everybody knows not to bring a gun on a fucking plane. You can't even bring a large moisturizer on a plane.
I'm it's trying just, to figure out how I'm getting Listerine when I go on a trip. I'm over here like pouring things into tiny bottles, like. And Madison Cawthorn's just like, let's take a loaded weapon.
So this is the second time. Did you know that?
I did.
This is the second time. Really.
You have to wonder, like, is he dumb? Is he dumb? Because you would think, okay, there were definitely people defending him on Twitter who were like, by the way, you can bring a firearm onto a plane if you check it in your bag and you let the TSA know that you're doing it. I'm like, well, clearly True. That didn't happen. So in this case...
Even in this particular case, it's a lot of the people who support Madison Cawthorn. I think it's important to kind of get there because, like, he's ridiculous and he's a terrible person. But more distressing, he was elected by people. Like, someone was like, you know what I have the option for? A responsible, thoughtful adult to represent me in Congress. Or I could choose Madison Cawthorn. And they chose Madison Cawthorn. That's
you pay this man's salary. I guess we do, right?
We all pay.
Terrible.
And in case, you know, depending on how long he's in Congress for, if he's able to get reelected despite the fact that he's being challenged on the ballot right now and has to deal with runoffs Please. And all this fun stuff. If he stays there long enough, we also have to pay for his pension, his health care. We're just doing all of it.
I mean, I really hope he has been cited. Okay, let's go through. He has been cited for so many things, this man, that we just have to. I mean, we are just, there is no God if one of his court dates is not on his like election day or when he has a debate or something. If you are not caught up, Madison Cawthorn was caught trying to bring a loaded gun through airport security at the airport in Charlotte in North Carolina, the state he represents. This is the second time this has happened that he has gotten this type of citation. He also brought a knife to a school board meeting. That sounds like
a gunfight, in other words.
No, that's true. I mean, a lot of people are bringing guns to school board. Terrible. This country. Terrible. In addition to racking up citations for driving with a revoked license, this guy is just constant. I mean, he can't drive without a revoked license. He has a revoked license and he just keeps racking these up.
He can't drive.
Menace to society. How is this man? I just think about like.
I don't know. I think if anything, like this is just a very, very salient example to people who care of how our elected officials have just completely gone in a character sense across the board. Just totally, totally not the type of people who should be the public servants. Like that's kind of this is a very clear example of it. You have it, you know, within the Democratic Party too. Like sure. People who are not making, I don't know, let's say the most sacrificial choices. But Dianne Feinstein. But but Madison Cawthorn is like, let me put people in danger. And how is he not embarrassed about it? That's what I don't understand. I guess. Some people can't feel embarrassment, and he must be one of them. So I'll just go with that.
I mean, antisocial behavior. At this, also, he's 25 years old. I'm like, what are his parents doing? Get his parents involved. I mean, not to blame his mother, not to make women responsible for everything.
He's an adult. In theory, his frontal lobe should be finishing up its development around now.
True. That's the, I fear you just gave him an excellent excuse for if he ever tries to justify this behavior.
No.
This man cannot be reelected. I mean, I was in North Carolina over the weekend, and just like every time we saw somebody pulled over, I was like, oh, look, it's Madison Cawthorn. It's just constantly. It's always him. It's always in a different car. It's never. My favorite part is like that one of the times he was pulled over and he clearly was so surprised to hear that the car wasn't registered in his name. So I maintain it was registered in his parents' name. Get involved there. If you're paying for your kid's car, you can maybe tell them, like, rip them a new one for bringing a gun on a plane or trying to. Because can you imagine this was Ilhan Omar or something? Like, it's just crazy.
Yeah. You're talking about somebody who the party has no shame. Like, he was to mention, like, cocaine parties, and they were like, ooh, none of that. But then they're like, oh, yeah, all of our text messages have been opened about how we were plotting a coup. Well, that's fine. You know, it happens. And you're like, okay, so like there's no shame left in the Republican Party. They're just kind of embarrassed. It's like, oh man, we ended up with a guy who brings weapons everywhere and threatens people with them, and you know, has a long history of sexual assault allegations against him. You know, there's he's basically just tiny proto Trump. It's all the time. This is who they are now.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
So you referenced the texts. We got into the coup texts, the famous coup texts, a little bit yesterday, but I wanted to really dive into them today. We talk about Mark Meadows' texts a lot, but this is definitely the most revealing set so far. There are about 2,300 and apparently 1,000 more that Meadows would not share. I cannot imagine what are in there. It includes texts from family, close advisors, state-level officials, Fox News hosts, and 40 current and former Republican members of Congress. Before we get into all the treason, which we will, I do want to indulge some of the more hapless moments. Ivanka Trump, I don't know why I think this is so silly, but Ivanka Trump, she just sounds like a doofus. She sent a note on November 5th to a group chat from hell that includes Jared Kushner, Hope Hicks, Jason Miller, and Mark Meadows, telling them, quote, "You are all warriors of epic proportions. Keep the faith and fight." How lame.
Oh my God, that is so exactly. What day did she send that?
November 5th.
Oh, November 5th.
So this was after Election Day. Yeah.
Okay. You know, that, oh, I love the picture that that paints, because if there's no other text from her, she was probably just like, oh, I can't even deal with this. She's probably taking calls for just from her like settee in her fucking giant ass closet, like a Kathy Hilton sized closet. And that's all she's doing.
Eating
and then
dinner
she's
for
like,
the TV.
Right. And then she's like, let me send daddy's friends an encouraging message. Thanks for all their help. And then she like writes that fucking dumbass message and everyone's like, what the hell is she up to?
Totally. And if I'm Hope Hicks, I'm kind of like, maybe I'm giving Hope Hicks too much credit, but I'm like, why am I on here?
No, this is inner circle. This is inner circle.
She ironed his pants while he was wearing them. She's absolutely on that list, okay? You know, she's in that group chat. She's in all the group chats.
I mean, the text before that is like, Claudette tomorrow, then you all are warriors. Like, it's just...
Wait. Who's the group? Jared.
It's Jared Kushner, Jason Miller, and then there's one other guy who, his last name was like Stepien, I think.
Oh,
I can't remember.
Bill Stepien.
Yes.
He's an important man to them.
Who is he again?
He was like a campaign manager type. Like, I think he was technically the campaign manager for a minute. Like, they all just... The org chart is not really relevant. It's really more of like an org circle, like this group chat,
yeah.
You know? And now that's actually very interesting that those are like the high key people.
Those are her warriors. I wonder if she has them saved.
Warriors. She's like, she sends like the soul bright cycle branding. Warrior. Yeah. Renegade.
So Rick Perry also looked a little embarrassed in these. He has previously denied texting like treasonous ideas to Meadows, but in these new documents, he says a lot of crazy shit and then he signs his text Rick Perry. Like when your dad is like, love you, dad.
This is gorgeous. I love everything about it. He treats text like email. I am, and no, on top of it, it just brings you back to that sweet, sweet moment in those 2016 primaries where he was eliminating three major federal pieces of the, like pieces of federal administration. He was like, I'm going to eliminate. And then he like went through two and he couldn't remember the third one. And people were just like at that point trying to like lob him what the third one might be. And he was like, nah, that's not it. I'll get back to it.
Not a smart man. Not a smart man. Not a smart man.
He's really one of the dumbest.
One of the dumbest. And he had like a dumb role in the first impeachment too, right? He was like trying to, I don't know, something with oil and gas, TBT.
No. What he said is he was in a debate and he wanted to get rid of three agencies.
Yeah.
And he couldn't name the three agencies that he wanted to get rid of.
Right. But I think he was also part of like the first impeachment, wasn't he? He was like trying to get, I don't know. There's definitely an element there.
I remember his role in that
in
one.
The Ukraine thing?
I think so. Maybe I'm thinking of, I always get him and some other.
I think I know who you're talking about that you're confusing with Rick Perry. Like there's another guy who cosplays a little similarly. I don't know who you're thinking of. I think that person might be from Florida though.
Potentially. But regardless, in this case, Perry had like a pretty explicit role. He connected Meadows to a DOG official whose name is Jeffrey Clark, and he was pushing unfounded claims of voter fraud in the Justice Department, and Trump had considered installing him as Attorney General. So Perry was telling Meadows, like, let's hook these two up. Let's make it happen. Dream team.
Oh, so Perry was the bridge in that one. Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
You always really wonder how did like these certain figures like get pulled in? Someone like a Jeffrey Clark. I can't even remember all the names of the on that list, but there are a lot of those characters. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, oh, some fucking Republican from one of the states who's like, oh, let me win some points. It's like, here, let me make an intro.
That's exactly what all these texts are. I mean, that's it's you know, like state officials in Arizona saying, like, we're looking for the fraud. Just everybody trying to tell Mark Meadows for a while, we're doing our best. We need you to do this. And between the insurrection and the election and the insurrection, there are just so many examples of people doing similar things to Rick Perry. I'm wondering what stood out the most to you in these? Because there have been lots of leaks. We have seen a lot of Mark Meadows' text inbox, but what stood out about these?
Honestly, the convenience of Marjorie Taylor Greene's texts while she's on this trial or law, while this lawsuit is being not a trial, while this lawsuit is being brought against her for her ineligibility to run for office because of her involvement in January 6th, it is convenient that these texts popped up. It makes me feel like, oh, maybe there is like a small chance something, you know, happens there where she isn't able to run again. But that's really all that was really the most interesting part to me, but mostly because of how those two stories combined as a timeline. Also, Mark Meadows, is this man handing out gold stars or some shit? Because everybody is trying to get on his good side.
Yeah, I mean, as far as all of the texts sent on or before January 6th, a number of Republican reps, including Marjorie Taylor Greene, at one point asked the president to do something to get the insurrectionists to step down. There's a sense of desperation in the texts, for sure, but it's not fear or disgust with the violence itself. Most of them seem to be telling Mark Meadows that Trump needs to intervene to save their brand. Like, this is bad for us if he doesn't intervene. Not a lot of, this is just terrible for the country. This is a tragedy. We've seen that from others, but not much in this trench. Don Jr. at one point texted Mark Meadows, quote, they will try to fuck his entire legacy on this if it gets worse. But then Jason Miller suggested to Meadows that the White House start suggesting that the blame fell on Antifa, and shortly after that, members of Congress started spreading this idea around. This included Marjorie Taylor Greene, who is, as we mentioned, currently facing a legal challenge to disqualify her from running for Congress because of her alleged role in January 6th. In court testimony, you've probably seen, she's claiming she does not remember what she said around or on the events of January 6th, but that is not true. On December 31st, Greene reached out to Meadows for advice about how to prepare for objections to certifying the election, which as what seems to be connected to her current trial. Caitlin, do you see this the timing of this leak to potentially impact that?
I have to admit, like, the thing overall to me it's so open and so cavalier that to some degree you start disbelieving it yourself. Like, you start actually adding, like, well, it could be, like, no, it's just exactly what it looks like. They are plotting to overturn an election, which is a coup. If there's no, like, complicated thing, like, well, people try all sorts of things. Like, I remember, you know, in the wake of the horrible nightmare that was 2016, you know, people were trying to figure out any legal way we could not necessarily overturn the election, but go and find out what the fuck had just happened. Mm-hmm. People were like, let's do recounts. Let's do this. Because we were, right. But we weren't like, and people were like, let's stop him from getting elected, from taking the oath of office. Let's do something. But it was not trying to necessarily undo the election as much as like make sense of what the hell had just happened and possibly impose any kind of restriction on this, as we now know, complete psycho taking over the government. And this is just so blatantly, so obviously, they're just sitting there plotting, trying to destroy the country. I'm baffled. And, you know, I kind of hope that she gets kind of screwed on this lawsuit, because that's a blueprint for a lot of other people to be removed from the ballot, and possibly even for Congress. If Democrats can ever find a spine one day, we dream that they might use the 14th Amendment to stop these. I don't want to be ableist. Crazy feels like a very appropriate word here.
It's not crazy. Let's just go with treasonous. That's the basis. They're treasonous. That's it.
Right, right. Yes. So as you said, all of this is mind-blowing. Every time there's a leak, it is. I don't want to say we're coming numb to it, because I continue to be surprised, but the House January 6th Committee is preparing to reveal some of its findings in a series of hearings this June. I'm wondering if we think these leaks have kind of taken the wind out of their sails, or do you think, like most Americans, probably haven't been paying attention, but will absolutely tune into days of congressional testimony, which I don't know if historically that's proven correct.
I don't think that the leaks are taking the wind out of the sails. I think the ship is taking the wind out of the, you know, that this the whole way that
it's the leaks, not us, not really hustling.
It's like it's just they're fighting a machine in a timeline that is very difficult to beat, and they are not, they don't seem willing to employ like more ruthless tactics, I guess. Yeah, I just think they're operating again like it's 2002, and it's not. So
the problem is actually that they're operating like it's 2002. And in 2002, there was, in fact, a giant messaging machine telling everybody that if you didn't agree with endless surveillance, like starting a war in Iraq and lots of other terrible shit, that you were un-American. There was we were living deluged in a time, and like the Democrats have just continued. This is a 2-decade long period where Democrats just step back. I guess assume that someone somewhere is going to be good and that truth wins. Mm-hmm. I got to tell you, that's not accurate. You need to repeatedly punch lies in the face. This should be, you know what they should get? They should get, I'm going to be a little religious here. They should get like Kris Jenner or somebody on this. Can you imagine if Kris Jenner wanted to bring attention to something? Could you imagine anything stopping her?
No.
Could you, it would be set up like a launch. Those June hearings would be like, everyone would be on them. There would be 5 different hashtags that you could use. We would all have like
a, it'd be a soft launch. Yes, absolutely.
They would put together an entire thing for Instagram stories. You would have like a frame, like they would create a new format just so you could put things up on Instagram about these hearings.
They would get a deal with Hulu.
It would be outrageous. We would have an entirely different world. But no, Democrats don't want a message ever. Oh, the truth will set you free. You just need to just believe. You know, this is like Care Bear Land. I don't know what's going on here.
Well, here's the issue. People with that sort of ruthless sense of messaging, I think, just fundamentally don't become Democratic operatives or politicians, and it's just sort of fundamentally at odds to who the Democratic Party is and who they attract. Those people, if they want to get into politics, they go into the Republican side where the money's probably a little better.
Jackie Kennedy was a queen of messaging. The only reason anyone thinks Jack Kennedy is worth shit, like half a century later, could just be clear, he was trash all the way down. And even to her, especially to her, let's just talk about this.
Right, so especially to her.
An entire legend out of Jack Kennedy. Okay? She was draped in his brain matter and walked around letting herself get photoed so that way she could make an impression about what exactly had just happened.
Do you think she was thinking about that at the time?
Yes.
She was she was a boss at every level. The fact that we don't have anybody, like, you don't need to be evil. Jackie Kennedy was not necessarily evil, but she was smart, intense, driven, knew what needed to get done, and she was willing to do it.
I'm trying to think, like, what is, I'm going to be thinking about this for days. Like, what would Kris Jenner, like, what would be, because now I'm thinking all about how, like, our Kardashian episode, we had a, like, Kardashian expert where she compared them to the Kennedys and their, like, performance. And now I'm just going to be thinking about what could happen, what plot lines they could orchestrate. Sammy, what do you think?
I mean, we would have, here's the problem. Like, they're set up too late. We're too late for this to work, but I think, like, at this point we're so behind the ball that I don't know.
What do you think? I believe in the power of Kris Jenner. Let me put it that way. Like, I think if you told her that we needed this to happen and you were willing to pay her the money to make it happen,
like, what is the crevice of the January 6th hearings coming up? Like, what is that moment?
Oh, that's
like, I think we need, like, two congresspeople to get into, like, an illicit affair and then also be involved in, like, have really high, I don't know. We need a storyline.
Maybe.
I think that the drama of this lends itself. You just need to, like,
that's what Jamie Raskin says. He says it's going to blow the roof off, which I thought was a terrible metaphor about the insurrection. He said it's going to blow the roof off the Capitol.
Okay, when I say, like, start over, I mean they need to come up with a new venue in which to share these hearings. And I think Caitlin was sort of alluding to that and saying, like, there would be a new way to, like, share it. But I think it's that they need to be more creative. Like, no one's tuning into C-SPAN or MSNBC or CNN all day. Fox News is not covering it the same way. Like, they need to sort of flood the zone. So they need to figure out where to flood the zone, and they really need more, like, stars. I know that's, like...
No, they do.
Mallory McMorrow's... They need, like, a Mallory McMorrow of the January 6th mm-hmm. committee who's gonna, you know, kill
yeah,
it every
and
day.
Which just, like, once again, could have been Kamala. Not of the committee, but of, like, part of this moment. I mean, what do you think that... What opportunities do you think that they have, Caitlin, that they still have available to them to, like, paint a really compelling picture that will just disgust Americans out of at least maybe considering voting for Trump again? Like, what's a dream scenario outcome of these hearings specifically?
I mean, not just of the hearings, but, like, the Democratic Party. I mean, Mallory McMorrow kind of set the pace. So we need to switch fundamentally to attacking the Republican Party. This is a thing I've said for a very long time. I feel bad that I'm saying it again. But, you know, if it continues being true.
Applies every single week. Gotta go ahead. If it's Wednesday, it applies.
Have I mentioned destroying the Republican Party today? The focus has to be on a pathologic... I'm not going to get that one out. Okay, pathologizing, there we go. The Republican Party as, like, you know, as an enemy. It's about clarifying, you know, the threat that they pose. And then, of course, most importantly, following up by not negotiating with them on other things. Right. Because then you undermine your own point. If these people are actually evil, psycho Nazis trying to overthrow the government, then you are a crazy person for trying to negotiate with them when they would like to destroy you. And then it gives the impression that, like, maybe it's good to negotiate with fascists, which it is absolutely not under any circumstances. You build a narrative, you let it rise, you let it stay in people's heads, you talk about how this is really terrible, like, all this other stuff, and then the text messages, everything that they talk about lands in a context where people are already willing and ready to see the problem for what it is.
Do you think that there's any benefit in, like, rehashing January 6th in almost a Benghazi style way. Like, I think if you remember that day, like, people who are not engaged whatsoever were really shocked by what they were watching on their televisions. And I wonder if that would be, like, that reminder is something that would be welcome, or if it would repel people.
I think it would be, you know, it was interesting because, like, I was, you know, people were asking what your favorite day on Twitter was. Like, one of my friends had tweeted that out, and people were retweeting with, like, you know, lots of things, including Trump getting COVID.
I mean,
but when you talk about, like, a moment that everybody was actually engaged 100%, January 6th has to be up there. It's a screwed up thing to say that, like, oh, the coup was the day, but everything stopped. Like, everyone remembers what was happening when they found out that there was a mob trying to kill our representatives to overturn an election. Everybody remembers where they were. It was a worldwide broadcast. Nobody was tuned out. So I think that bringing it back might actually remind people why, like, any of this matters. Because right now it feels a little bit, ironically, like I mentioned Kris Jenner, but it feels kind of like a reality show. All flash, no substance. It doesn't really matter what happens because whatever, next season's going to happen anyway. And it's like, no, America is not a running syndicated show. It is not like this. It's not a reality show. It is going to come with some massive impacts. It already has. And we have to engage. And maybe this will do it. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But they should try. Somebody try. Please
try. Get caught trying.
Get caught trying. Absolutely. Yeah. They need to get some moments like for midterm ads and that. And like they have Marjorie Taylor Greene saying, you know, these people felt that they needed to, like, I'd announce this, but these people felt like they had no other choice. Have that text, like have these texts with the scenes behind them to really paint a picture.
Actually, a slogan that could be there could be got caught trying for all of these people trying to overthrow the government.
What if we project it into the sky like a bat signal? So it can't be ignored.
I mean, Batman is about fighting political corruption, ironically enough, and police misconduct.
What do you think our listeners should be looking for? Like, do you think they're going to drop some knowledge that we have not heard before that are not in the leak specifically? Like,
yes,
I think what I'm going to look out for is connections of Trump and the White House coordinating with people that knew it would be violent and wanted it to be violent. And I was reading that they're really focusing on whether Trump decided when he was up there to say, let's all march to the Capitol, or if it's quite likely that that was already predetermined. And he knew he was arriving to an fired up, angry base of people, and he was going to tell them to go to the Capitol. And I guess, what does it matter if either of those things are true?
I mean, true is irrelevant to the consequences. I think that we know that regardless of what happens in the hearings. I think there will be a lot that we learn from them, because as much as we all sort of like know or have ideas or little pieces of evidence of certain things that have allowed us to form a certain narrative about it, I think that when we have many more pieces, it will all paint a different picture. I think it will paint a much more intentional picture than, you know, the average witness of that day. And I think that some of the things that we learn will be very salient.
Yeah.
Love that.
We'll see. We'll see if it matters, though. Again, that's separate from whether it matters.
See, if you were a lawmaker that said that on MSNBC, I'd be like, ooh, I want to go watch that. Yeah, I think it will be very salient.
I guess they should cut me off before I say it doesn't matter.
I think that one of the big things is going to be, who knew what was happening and when did they know it? Because what we're seeing now is like a pattern of behavior, but there's going to be some bigger things. Like, we've heard about like lawmakers who gave tours of the Capitol to people who were a part of that mob. That's a huge deal right there. To me, that's like, you know, that's the connection. We've got who removed, who were the internal supports who removed things like panic buttons out of Democratic House members' offices. Huge deal. Like, we need to know the answer to that. There's a lot of like really nefarious stuff. And I think they should like actually paint this a little bit like a psychological thriller. where we already know the conclusion, the violence, the everything, but then pull back and it's like, how did this happen? Who knew what? Who's the inside man? Like all of this other stuff. And, grab Spike Lee, grab some great, we have so many great fiction people on our side, so many great storytellers.
Stephen King.
You're so right. I mean, as I was like, because I asked at the beginning, like, what are the storylines? Like, the storylines are there. If you told me this was going to be a 12-part series on HBO, I would watch it. It's just like, we don't have the right performers in the right roles. We need more.
Here's the thing. I think that the details of this, let's say you put them in a psychological thriller of a book, you couldn't even get them all in the book, is actually how I think that we're going to feel about what we will now see.
You could, I think that absolutely they should start doing like almost like a little, almost like a small bore story, like Welcome to Night Vale or something like that. That just like starts to pull the whole thing together in these small episodic ways.
This is what Kris Jenner would do. She would also release crime thriller novels for various sequences of like Babysitter's Club, but there's just like novels for each episode and you could like buy them in the airport.
Someone come up with the covers of like a Nancy Drew type shit, okay?
Oh, those were, and the attic, yeah, that stuck with me.
Yeah.
The clock in the attic.
Make them erotica, whatever people want to pick it up, I don't know.
You know what I think they should do? Maybe this won't work on like desktop, but I guess you could build it for mobile too. You know how back in the day, I mean, it would maybe be better if Elise were here as a big Harry Potter fan, but they used to have like Harry Potter website where you could like look at the, like it was like a supplemental explanation of Harry Potter.
Right.
Like I think that would be cool. It was like go to insurrection.com and like fill in and like find out like,
Do you know what I think?
With like FAQ and like maybe there's even a chat feature where you could have a little staffer who's like, where you could ask a question. Can you explain this part? And then the staffer from the committee is like, here's the section that you want to read in the report.
Build a desktop, a tabletop gaming where you could play role play as one of the people.
I really love where we have
to start the insurrection or stop it.
Yeah. As you were talking, this would just totally be co-opted by like right-wingers to just be like insurrection fan fiction. But I think these are good thoughts, and I really hope the Democratic Party is taking some into consideration. Use the tech available to you, y'all. It's 2022. We will be watching. I am terrified that the Roe decision is going to come during this set of hearings. But we'll forget I said that. Don't internalize that. It's all right. We
don't have to think about it.
It also could potentially be when I'm in France and I won't have to deal with it. I'm going on vacation. So have fun with that.
Oh,
also, actually, me and Sammy, I think we're both out the same week. It's like early June.
Are we?
Yeah. It'll be very fun for Bridget to cover the end of Roe and the hearings. No, we will hope for a good timeline. And we're always here. We're always here.
I'll still do morning announcements. It's better because when I'm ahead, I'm less annoying to the team.
If Roe is overturned, I am beaming in from France.
Do you want me to just go to Europe permanently and make everything easier for everyone? I don't mind.
Works for me, Sammy.
I'll take the sacrifice.
I'll go.
If Europe will take you, let's all go. Sounds good.
They might not have to deal with Twitter anymore if they violate the new EU regulations. First, Twitter is going to get fined, I think, like 6%, sanctioned 6% of its revenue. And then if they don't continue to comply, if they continue not complying, they will not be able to operate in Europe. So another reason why I could go there.
Yes, definitely.
But then where am I going to get my news? So
true. And Sammy just brought up Twitter. So on that note, we will be back shortly to talk to Axios Media Trends reporter Sarah Fisher, who is going to break down what was happening behind the scenes as Elon Musk bought Twitter and what we should expect to see in the next 6 months. Stay tuned.
We all dread the what should we have for dinner question. I know I do. I love a home-cooked meal, but I don't always have the time, energy, or groceries to make it happen. Being able to feast on a delicious meal without the long prep and cook times is what drew me to Home Chef over the other guys. Home Chef's meals are effortless, so I can spend less time trying to be top chef and more time watching it. Whether you prefer classic meal kits with pre-portioned ingredients and easy instructions, speedy recipes ready in less than 30 minutes, oven-ready kits with pre-chopped ingredients, or quick microwave meals that assemble in minutes, minutes, Home Chef has you covered for delicious meals without the hassle. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. Home Chef has over 30 options a week and serves a variety of dietary needs, so you never have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. For a limited time, Home Chef is offering our listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life, and of course, free shipping on your first box. Go to homechef.com/feverdream. That's homechef.com/feverdream for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard that right. homechef.com/feverdream. Must be an active subscriber to receive free dessert.
We are back now with Sarah Fisher. She is a media trends reporter from Axios who authors the Media Trends newsletter, which analyzes trends in digital media. And we have a huge story in digital media to discuss, of course, this morning. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So this was a will they or won't they for a while. I'm talking, of course, about Elon Musk buying Twitter, with Twitter appearing to take steps to prevent Musk from buying the company. What do you think changed for them as somebody who has watched this play out? What factors went into Twitter's calculus that observers like need to really understand?
Well, I think that they were put into a corner. They didn't have much of a choice. You know, Elon Musk put out a filing with the Securities Exchange Commission last week, essentially saying that if they didn't accept his bid, he was going to either A, go directly to shareholders and offer to buy their shares at a premium, and then B, through a tender offer, if that didn't work, you know, possibly do a proxy battle, meaning he'd team up with other shareholders to essentially overthrow the board. And so what Twitter figured was, all right, at this point, it's better to kind of work with him, accept this bid, then get into some sort of very, very nasty battle where all of our leadership could be uprooted automatically. At least this gives them 6 months before the deal closes to sort of work with him, negotiate, figure out what his plan is in terms of getting shareholders in the company that work at the company, like employees paid out, all this type of stuff. But it's really not ideal for Twitter.
Can you shine some light on how this went down behind the scenes? Like when they rebuffed him and he, you know, how does he come back to them and say, well, if you don't take my offer, these are the things I'm going to do?
Yeah. So Elon came out with a bid. Well, let me rewind. Elon came out and disclosed a 9.2% stake in Twitter, which is pretty significant. And the first reaction from Twitter and analysts was, okay, this is a pretty significant stake that he's been amassing over the next few months. Is his goal here to maybe take over Twitter? What's the end point? Then Elon Musk comes out and says, look, I'm going to offer to buy Twitter for $54 a share, which, by the way, is a pretty big premium compared to where Twitter was already trading at. I think it was trading at around $48. So Twitter's board has a very smart response, and they say, look, we'll give you a position on the board. You can take that as long as you agree that you're never going to increase your stake in the company over a certain amount. And they thought that that was going to be enough to hold Elon Musk back. But what happened is over a matter of a few days, Elon Musk changed his mind. He backs out of the board. And at this point, Twitter's board's pretty freaked out. They think, oh my gosh, if he is backing out, he's probably going to look to do a full takeover bid. So what Elon Musk does is he goes and he essentially talks to his back-end folks and his finance, personal finances, tries to figure out, all right, how do I come up with the right number? He puts out a proposal. And then that first proposal does not have any details about how he's going to actually pay for Twitter, because you have to understand, Elon Musk isn't super liquid. Like, lots of his money is tied up in Tesla stock. Finally comes back a few days later, and he says that he has some debt financing from Morgan Stanley. Twitter's board tries to push him off by invoking what's called a poison pill, which is like a defensive corporate strategy that would essentially dilute the stock for Elon Musk, making it more expensive for him to buy it out. But ultimately, Elon kind of called their bluff. He came up with the financing, and Twitter's board, once backed into a corner, just had to accept the bid.
Mm-hmm. I have a question on in terms of, you know, his motivation. So do you think that this was purely always about him wanting Twitter, like, for its own sake? Or do you think that their resistance to him owning Twitter almost turned it into like an ego thing? Like, they're saying, I can't have it, so I'm going to try even harder to get it.
Such a smart question. I think it's a little bit of both. I think Elon Musk is a very impulsive person. In some ways, that has led to some of his greatest innovations. But in other ways, he has, you know, made some mistakes. And I think he saw this as a free speech move. And the resistance that he got, not just from Twitter, but from other folks publicly, I think it did motivate him. It motivated him because he saw this counterculture of people sort of silencing, you know, speech and dissent rally up against his bid. And it kind of fired him up even more to say, look, there's a problem with free speech that I want to take after it. But I really do want to stress the point of Elon Musk being a very impulsive person. Yeah. I think that played a lot into this.
Mm-hmm. And just to continue talking a little bit about Twitter's motivation, I heard you say in an interview with CNN, I think on Monday, that Twitter has struggled with profitability, with one factor potentially being how much they've invested in safety and security. To me, this sounds like because Twitter has spent so much on making the platform safer, they might have now been forced to sell themselves to a person whose ideas for the platform might make it less safe, which leads me to the question of, is making social media platforms safer and more pleasant just bad business?
I couldn't disagree more. I think, and that's not your assumption, that's what other people are saying. I think when you make them safer, you make them a better place for advertisers to want a message. And I think that's actually the biggest risk right now, is if you pull back a lot of the guardrails, blue chip advertisers, meaning big brands, I think are going to be a lot more hesitant about wanting to spend with the platform. And Twitter is unique compared to Facebook or Google because it's much more heavily reliant on some of those big name brand advertisers. Okay. It also has a lot of partnerships with premium publishers in terms of, you know, partnerships to broadcast clips from sports games or to run live feeds of award shows. You know, publishers are not going to want to work with Twitter if they think it's become just like a cesspool of misinformation and hate speech.
That's a really interesting point. In terms of, do you think that, you know, you spoke to Musk's impulsivity. Do you think there's a chance that he could, you know, I think people are sort of predicting this almost like dystopian turn that Twitter will take and that we're all going to be trapped in it. But in reality, Twitter is not that popular outside of, you know, a very particular subset of people. So do you think there's any chance that, or, you know, what do you think the chances are that Elon Musk runs Twitter into the ground, so to speak, not even necessarily financially, but in terms of its importance, its relevance no longer will be what it is now?
I think in the short term, imagine Twitter like a needle in a haystack. All those pieces of hay are the different algorithms, bureaucratic aspects of its company, layers of corporate management that are going to have to be sort of peeled and parsed through before he could find the needle, which is, you know, the one major algorithm switch that he wants to make. And so I think in the short term, he's not going to be able to just with a flick of a button completely and fundamentally change Twitter, because he knows that if he does that, there are big security implications. There are big implications for users fleeing. But I think in the long term, yes, he'll continue to make incremental decisions that will ultimately make Twitter a platform that is less, you know, moderated, less, it's just not going to look the same as it does today. What will it look like? I mean, there are some folks that are arguing that if Elon can construct it right, maybe it looks more like a Reddit, where there aren't as many clampdowns on free speech, but the communities are a little bit more siloed so that like the most crazy stuff doesn't automatically go so viral. The challenge here is that Elon Musk just hasn't spoken at length enough about his plans. You know, he says, I want to make the algorithms open source. Okay, fine. I want to make an edit button. Okay, fine. But he hasn't laid out any concrete details as to how he would come down on certain aspects of speech. In fact, some of the things that he's laid out are quite contradictory. In one case, he says, I will adhere to whatever local laws of the country right. in which we are residing. Well, certain speech is very different in certain countries. Mm-hmm. So where, what lines are you going to draw? And then in other cases, he completely contradicts himself by saying, well, you know, people should be able to say essentially whatever they want. I don't think he's thought it through, as my final answer mm-hmm. for you. And because of that, it's hard to say exactly which direction it will go in. But what I do know is, no matter how smart or how well-resourced you are, one, there's a lockup period. So you can't make any substantial changes till the deal closes, and that won't be for 6 months. So don't expect changes in 6 months. And then two, okay. even if he does try to come in, you know, guns a-blazing and torch the thing down, like I said, imagine that needle in a haystack. It's hard when you have a big corporation to just kind of come dismantle it overnight.
Got it. Yeah.
Do you think there's any chance that this deal will fall apart before it ends up going through?
Great question. So that would depend on there being other bidders for Twitter. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the reasons the board jumped on this is because there were not other bidders for Twitter. And there was some speculation over the past week or so that other private equity firms would team with Twitter to try to sort of buy it out from underneath Elon. There was speculation that Elon would team with other private equity firms to finance the bid. Ultimately, neither of those things happened, which has sort of led me to believe that some of these private equity giants were too scared, that the juice was not worth the squeeze, that there was not enough financially to make getting involved in this worth it in the long run. And so I don't think you're going to see other bidders. If they were there, we would not have had the board jump on Elon's bid.
Yeah. My last question is, why do you think that Elon Musk thinks the juice is worth the squeeze? I mean, these companies are notoriously challenging to run, notoriously. And he has a number of other companies that are also, I hear, you know, they, rocket ships are pretty hard. Brain science sounds difficult. I mean, what is he getting himself into? Do you think it sounds like you don't, since he's so impulsive, he might not grasp like the real challenges here?
Yes. And by the way, these are such great questions. I love your
podcast. Oh, thanks, Sarah.
I love like talking. You. It's like really fun to talk to you guys.
Oh,
you're
cool.
So smart. you know, I think there's a fundamental change happening in America and around the world around free speech. And it's become a major issue for big thinkers and billionaires, because what they say could change the nature of their innovations and the companies that they're running. You know, classic example, Elon once sent a tweet that triggered an SEC investigation into Tesla. And so now it's something that they care a lot about. And I think he wants to play a bigger role in dictating the future of free speech. And he's not the only high-profile billionaire to do so. I mean, Jeff Bezos bought the Washington Post. William Powell Jobs bought a majority stake in The Atlantic. You know, Reid Hoffman is investing in a misinformation, an anti-misinformation public benefit corporation. Like, this is something that a lot of high profile people are getting into. They're not taking as big of a swing at it as Elon, but they also don't have the resources that Elon does. So I think he wants to play a bigger role in dictating the future of free speech. I think he's felt burned by quote unquote cancel culture. And I think he's felt like he wants to do something about it. But in terms of the juice being worth the squeeze, is so why he's investing in Twitter versus other mechanisms. You know, he, one, is a massive user of Twitter. 80 million followers. And so I think he wants to have more control over the platform that has become his biggest vehicle for communicating both to investors and stakeholders and the general public. But then two, I think Twitter is really the town square for public debate in a way that Facebook and Instagram and Reddit and Snapchat are not. And so that's attractive to him. And then three, you know, he said, like, the economics don't matter to me. I don't think he's interested or cares about making money off the business.
Okay.
And notoriously, this has been a tough business to make money off of. And so the person who was eventually going to come in and buy Twitter, you know, they had to actually in some ways be motivated by things outside of the business economics, because Twitter has shown after 10 years of being public, more or less, that it's not a great business. So that's why I think a lot of private equity firms ultimately weren't super interested in taking it over. So I think that's Elon's motivation. I guess my thought bubble here is that my hope is he takes the time to really learn all of the debates that Twitter has already had to go through to make the current policies as they are. You know, some of the things around free speech that are so nuanced, a a great example. Like, what do you do with a terrorist group that's not designated as a terrorist organization by the United States? Do you police it like a terrorist group, right? So these are all things that, like, Twitter has in the past had to deal with. I hope Elon Musk takes the time to reconsider how thorny some of these issues were before making sweeping changes.
Yes, we definitely do too. I mean, nothing scarier than a man with nothing to lose. So then
he's actually like one of the last people in the world who I think would give the deserved consideration to such nuanced and important issues and potentially, we'll you know, life threatening in some cases. But also just speaking to the money piece, this speaks to one of, I think, the hazards of Elon Musk's success, and that he's been able to be so successful and be accumulate so much wealth and become the richest person in the world while his own companies don't necessarily even live up to the promises that they're making. Like, his, you know, Tesla, you could sort of argue, has it like met its valuation. So it's no surprise that Elon Musk does not care if he, you know, if Twitter's a fairly profitable business. Right. Like, this isn't about that. He's able to be the richest person in the world anyway.
Yeah, I agree. Although I would push back on one thing, which is that I think Elon Musk has had to make some pretty serious considerations in terms of morals and ethics and values. So I don't think he's unable to do it or unwilling. You know, a great example is in a self-driving car. If a small child is running in front of the car on one side and an elderly woman is running alongside the other, like, that car's algorithm, it needs to be programmed to make a decision. Mm-hmm. Those are moral and ethical implications. And those are meetings that Elon Musk has sat in on. Mm-hmm. I think the challenge is those have been not at the forefront of his decision-making in the public's eye. So we don't really get to see how he's come down and how he's made those choices. Whereas with Twitter, like, everything is going to be in the public eye, you know, whether or not you choose to ban an account or bring Donald Trump back. So we're going to see very quickly where he comes down on things. And as a result, he's going to have to make the decisions really quickly. And that's what's tricky. Like, with some of these moral things that he's had to deal with in terms of SpaceX or Starlink or Tesla, they're things that he could deal with repercussions behind the scene through thorough and thoughtful processes. Like, I don't know that he's going to get as much time to be thorough and thoughtful on Twitter, because if somebody says something that's so damaging to public safety, as was alleged during the Capitol 6 riot with Donald Trump, like, he needs to make a decision within a matter of hours. And that's where I don't know where Elon Musk comes down.
Yeah. So many interesting questions to come up. I'm curious what you will be watching most curiously in the next couple of months, and where people can get more of your analysis like this.
Oh, you're so kind for asking. The thing I'm going to be watching most closely in the next few months is how other billionaires and big, powerful figures respond to what Elon's doing. And if this inspires them to become even more proactive in this debate. Do we see it? People, you know, Reddit, for example, they want to go public for $15 billion valuation. Does someone instead just like buy Reddit for $15 billion? So that's one thing I'm watching. Yeah. And then, you know, I'm a reporter for Axios. I write a newsletter every week called Axios Media Trends, where I offer these analyses. But, you know, I also like to appear on podcasts and things like this. So I'd say, you know, following me on LinkedIn or following me on Twitter is probably the best way.
Yes. And we didn't have time to get into this today, but your most recent newsletter, Media Trends newsletter, has a lot of tea on CNN Plus. And you can also, if you didn't get that on your inbox, you can find, there's links to it on Axios. It's easy to find, but there's lots of great info in there. Thank you so much for joining us, Sarah.
Thanks for having me. Talk soon.
That is our show today. Until the end of democracy, I'm Amanda Duberman.
I'm Sammy Sage.
I'm Caitlin Berg.
And this is the Betches Up Podcast. Bye.
The Betches Sup podcast is produced by Amanda Duberman, Jorge Morales Pico, and Sean Kilby. Editing by Jorge Morales Pico. Social media by Amanda Duberman. Be sure to follow @Betches_Sup on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And send us your emails to suppod@betches.com. Betches.